Hello. We're roughly halfway through this fifth chapter on renunciation, following the chapter on concentration. Concentration, the power of our consciousness to reach out and grasp and hold fast to something, dharana. To identify with the one thing that we focus upon or with the one whom we focus upon everywhere. A positive power, as opposed to renunciation, the power to push ourselves away from something that we do not wish to hold near us, to reject sannyas, to disidentify, to say, that is not the essence of my being. A negative. So positive in concentration and negative in renunciation, both of them compatriots in the practice of yoga. We need both powers. The power to say yes to what is auspicious and the power to say no to what is inauspicious. So, midway through, we start here. Self-will in thought and action has, we have already seen, to be quite renounced if we would be perfect in the way of divine works. It has equally to be renounced if we are to be perfect in divine knowledge. This self-will means an egoism in the mind, which attaches itself to its preferences, its habits, its past or present formations of thought and view, and will, because it regards them as itself or its own, weaves around them the delicate threads of I-ness and my-ness, and lives in them like a spider in its web. This is the idea of the self. I do. This is the aspect of nature which makes the self, the ahamkara, the I maker. In the Gita, there are a couple of shlokas which are interesting in this light, but let's choose one. In the third chapter, the 27th shloka, while the actions are being done by the modes of nature, prakriti, he whose self is bewildered by egoism thinks it is his I that does them, his inner self. Actually, it is simply the ego that says, I am that. So we are seduced, in a sense, by nature into identification with the outer modes, not the inmost modes of nature, where Purusha and Prakriti are one, where they are restored to union. To get back to his paragraph, this attachment must be entirely excised from the mind. Not only must we give up the ordinary attitude to the world and life to which the unawakened mind clings as its natural element, but we must not remain bound in any mental construction of our own, or in any intellectual thought system, or arrangement of religious dogmas, or logical conclusions. We must not only cut asunder the snare of the mind and the senses, but flee also beyond the snare of the thinker, the snare of the theologian and the church builder, the meshes of the word, and the bondage of the idea. But we must always go beyond, always renounce the lesser for the greater, the finite for the infinite. We must be prepared to proceed from illumination to illumination, from experience to experience, from soul state to soul state, so as to reach the utmost transcendence of the divine and its utmost universality. Nor must we attach ourselves even to the truths we hold most securely, for they are but forms and expressions of the ineffable who refuses to limit himself to any form or expression. Always we must keep ourselves open to the higher word from above that does not confine itself to its own sense and the light of the thought that carries in it its own opposites. That is a thought with a capital T, because here we are in the realm of the supramental. That word that descends from above has no form in mere language, but exists prior to and fashions itself as the throbbing out of the infinite as it moves mightily into self-expression. But the center of all resistance is egoism. And this we must pursue into every covert and disguise and drag it out and slay it. This is the ahamkara, the I-making aspect of nature. For its disguises are endless, and it will cling to every shred of possible self-concealment. Well, altruism and indifference are often its most effective disguises. So draped, it will riot boldly in the very face of the divine spies who are missioned to hunt it out. Here, the formula of the supreme knowledge comes to our help. We have nothing to do on our essential standpoint with these distinctions. For there is no I nor thou, but only one divine self, equal in all embodiments, equal in the individual and the group. And to realize that, to express that, to serve that, to fulfill that, is all that matters. This is again from the Gita, Chapter 6, Shloka 29. The man whose self is in yoga sees the self in all beings, and all beings in the self. And he is equal visioned everywhere. Self-satisfaction and altruism, enjoyment and indifference, are not the essential thing. If the realization, fulfillment, service of the one self demands from us an action that seems to others self-service or self-assertion in the egoistic sense, or seems egoistic enjoyment and self-indulgence, that action we must do. We must be governed by the guide within, rather than by the opinions of men. You remember the passage in Sri Aurobindo's book, The Mother, where he says that in the dealing with wealth, one must be unattached. And if the divine appoints you to live in lush opulence, then you accept it. If the divine strips it all away and gives it to another, you accept it. In either way, your face smiles with benignant equality at whatever happens, because it is your identification with the divine Shakti that is all important. And that is felicity. Things that populate your life are of no matter when you have that. The influence of the environment works often with great subtlety. We prefer and put on almost unconsciously the garb which will look best in the eye that regards us from outside, and we allow a veil to drop over the eye within. We are impelled to drape ourselves in the vow of poverty, or in the garb of service, or in outward proofs of indifference and renunciation and a spotless sainthood, because that is what tradition and opinion demand of us, and so we can make best an impression on our environment. But all this is vanity and delusion. We may be called upon to assume these things, for that may be the uniform of our service, but equally it may not. The eye of man outside matters nothing. The eye within is all. We see in the teaching of the Gita how subtle a thing is the freedom from egoism which is demanded. Arjuna is driven to fight by the egoism of strength, the egoism of the kshatriya. He is turned from the battle by the contrary egoism of weakness, the shrinking, the spirit of disgust, the false pity that overcomes the mind, the nervous being, and the senses. Not that divine compassion which strengthens the arm and clarifies the knowledge. So you'll remember this. This is all the end of the first chapter and the beginning of the second, culminating in something like the fifth verse in the second shloka, and this Sri Aurobindo roughly renders here. Better the life of the beggar than to taste these blood-stained enjoyments. I desire not the rule of all the earth, no, nor the kingdom of the gods. I think I skipped the preface. But this weakness comes garbed as renunciation, as virtue. Better the life of the beggar than to taste these blood-stained enjoyments. I desire not the rule of all the earth, no, nor the kingdom of the gods. How foolish of the teacher, we might say, not to confirm this mood, to lose this sublime chance of adding one more great soul to the army of sannyasins, one more shining example before the world of a holy renunciation. But the guide sees otherwise, the guide who is not to be deceived by words. This is weakness and delusion and egoism that speak in thee. Behold the self, open thy eyes to the knowledge, purify thy soul of egoism. Roughly the second and third verse of the second chapter. And afterwards, fight, conquer, enjoy a wealthy kingdom. After much rich teaching in the practicum of yoga, in the theory of Vedanta, he comes to that in the 11th chapter, in the 33rd verse. Or to take another example from ancient Indian tradition, it was egoism, it would seem, that drove Rama, the avatar, to raise an army and destroy a nation in order to recover his wife from the king of Lanka. But would it have been a lesser egoism to drape himself in indifference and misusing the formal terms of the knowledge to say, I have no wife, no enemy, no desire. These are illusions of the senses. Let me cultivate the Brahman knowledge and let Ravana do what he will with the daughter of Janaka. But instead, Rama obeyed the guide within and did the evil and put down darkness in favor of light and rescued this daughter of Janaka. The criterion is within, as the Gita insists. It is to have the soul free from craving and attachment, but free from the attachment to inaction, akarmani, as well as from the egoistic impulse to action, free from attachment to the forms of virtue, as well as from the attraction to sin. And Sri Aurobindo is keying on the fourth chapter of the Gita again. I think it's important that we note these correspondences. The 18th shloka, chapter 4. He who in action can see inaction and can see action still continuing in cessation from works is the man of true reason and discernment among men. He is in yoga and a many-sided universal worker. It is to be rid of I-ness and my-ness so as to live in the oneself and act in the oneself, to reject the egoism of refusing to work through the individual center of the universal being, as well as the egoism of serving the individual mind and life and body to the exclusion of others. And this is the third chapter of the Gita, verse 17. But the man whose delight is in the self and who is satisfied with the enjoyment of the self, and in the self he is content, for him there exists no work that needs to be done. Work happens within him without his egoistic motivation. He does not think of it. The universal will, with the fiat from above, articulates itself through his willing person. To live in the self is not to dwell for oneself alone in the infinite, immersed and oblivious of all things in that ocean of impersonal self-delight, but it is to live as the self and in the self, equal in this embodiment and all embodiments and beyond all embodiments. This is the integral knowledge. And this is Gita 5:7. He who is in yoga, the pure soul, master of his self, who has conquered the senses, whose self becomes the self of all existences, even though he does works, he is not involved in them. It will be seen that the scope we give to the idea of renunciation is different from the meaning currently attached to it. Currently, its meaning is self-denial, inhibition of pleasure, rejection of the objects of pleasure. Self-denial is a necessary discipline for the soul of man because his heart is ignorantly attached. Inhibition of pleasure is necessary because his sense is caught and clogged in the mud honey of sensuous satisfactions. Rejection of the objects of pleasure is imposed because the mind fixes on the objects of pleasure. Because the mind fixes on the object and will not leave it to go beyond it and within itself. If the mind of man were not thus ignorant, attached, bound even in its restless inconstancy, deluded by the forms of things, renunciation would not have been needed. The soul could have traveled on the path of delight from the lesser to the greater, from joy to diviner joy. At present, that is not practicable. It must give up from within everything to which it is attached in order that it may gain that which they are in their reality. The external renunciation is not the essential. That is sannyasa. But even that is necessary for a time, indispensable in many things, and sometimes useful in all. We may even say that a complete external renunciation is a stage through which the soul must pass at some period of its progress, though always it should be without those self-willed violences and fierce self-torturings which are an offense to the divine seated within us, that too in the Gita. But in the end, this renunciation or self-denial is always an instrument in the period for its use passes. The rejection of the object ceases to be necessary when the object can no longer ensnare us, because what the soul enjoys is no longer the object as an object, but the divine which it expresses. The inhibition of pleasure is no longer needed when the soul no longer seeks pleasure, but possesses the delight of the divine in all things equally, without the need of a personal or physical possession of the thing itself. Self-denial loses its field when the soul no longer claims anything, but obeys consciously the will of the one self in all beings. It is then that we are freed from the law and released into the liberty of the spirit. And this is a bit later in the Gita, the 12th chapter, 3rd and 4th verse. But those who seek often the indefinable, unmanifest, immutable, omnipresent, unthinkable, self-poised, immobile, constant, they also, by restraining all their senses, by the equality of their understanding, and by their seeing of oneself in all things, and by their tranquil benignancy of silent will for the good of all existences, arrive to me. See, this is the core of Bhakti Yoga. Unity with the divine in all beings, amity, concord, attachment to the essential. We must be prepared to leave behind on the path not only that which we stigmatize as evil, but that which seems to us to be good, yet is not the one good. There are things which were beneficial, helpful, which seemed perhaps at one time the one thing desirable. And yet, once their work is done, once they are attained, they become obstacles and even hostile forces when we are called to advance beyond them. And Sri Aurobindo is writing here something that would become real for him a couple of years later when he hit an impasse in the practice of his own yoga and could not advance and sat still for 6 months. And then you remember that story about how the yogi walking wildly through the streets, celebrated as a sort of renegade from society, but wise nonetheless, came through the boulevard where Sri Aurobindo was sitting, looking out, and saw him and walked straight up the stairs. Usually there was a guard posted there. Nobody was there that day. He walked straight up the stairs, came to where Sri Aurobindo was sitting with a cup of tea in front of him, looked at him, looked at the cup of tea, took the tea, poured out the contents, and set the teacup back down, and then left, never to come back again. And Sri Aurobindo said that was the clue. He had to renounce all of his attainments, all of his realizations, the siddhis that were mounting up in him. He had to leave it all and become vacuous so that the omnipresent, the omniscient, could fill him anew with a whole range of greater splendors. and his yoga began again. But as he wrote this, that had not happened, so far as I'm aware. There are desirable states of the soul, which it is dangerous to rest in after they have been mastered, because then we do not march on to the wider kingdoms of God beyond. Even divine realizations must not be clung to if they are not the divine realization in its utter essentiality and completeness. We must rest at nothing less than the All, nothing short of the utter transcendence. And remember that Sri Aurobindo had begun with that utter transcendence in 1908 in Baroda, where he fell or was plunged into Brahmic Nirvana. And the All was what decidedly confronted him during his internment in the Alipur jail, where he came face to face, body to body, with Vasudeva, with the omnipresent being who occupies the good, the evil, the low, the high. Everything is dripping with the divine presence. With that experience, Sri Aurobindo, combined with the experience in Baroda, marched on towards Pondicherry, and arriving there, took up a greater tapasya, which took him to greater spiritual territory. But these two things that he writes of here were already secured in his own yoga before he got to Pondicherry. And if we can thus be free in the spirit, we shall find out all the wonder of God's workings. We shall find that in inwardly renouncing everything, we have lost nothing. By all this abandoned, thou shalt come to enjoy the All. He's paraphrasing here the first verse of the Isha Upanishad. All this is for the habitation of the Lord. By that renounced, you should enjoy. The beginning and the end of that verse. For everything is kept for us and restored to us, but with a wonderful change and transfiguration into the All Good and the All Beautiful, the All Light and the All Delight of Him who is forever pure and infinite, and the mystery and the miracle that ceases not through the ages. Satyam Shivam Sundaram. So we begin the synthesis of the systems of knowledge next week in chapter 6. If you have a moment more, let's read something from Savitri. This would be in Book 7, the Book of Yoga. Canto 6, Nirvana, and the All-Negating Absolute. We're going to begin on page 548. Near the top. The world is but a spark burst from its light. All moments flashes from its timelessness. All objects, glimmerings of the bodiless, that disappear from mind when that is seen. It held as if a shield before its face, a consciousness that saw without a seer, the truth where knowledge is not, nor knower, nor known, the love enamored of its own delight, in which the lover is not, nor the beloved, bringing their personal passion into the vast, the force omnipotent in quietude, the bliss that none can ever hope to taste. It cancelled the convincing cheat of self. A truth in nothingness was its mighty clue. If all existence could renounce to be, and being take refuge in non-being's arms, and non-being could strike out its ciphered round, some luster of that reality might appear. A formless liberation came on her. Once sepulchred alive in brain and flesh, she had risen up from body, mind, and life. She was no more a person in a world. She had escaped into infinity. What once had been herself had disappeared. There was no frame of things, no figure of soul, a refugee from the domain of sense, evading the necessity of thought, delivered from knowledge and from ignorance, and rescued from the true and the untrue. She shared the superconscient's high retreat beyond the self-born word, the nude idea, the first bare solid ground of consciousness. Beings were not there. Existence had no place. There was no temptation of the joy to be. Unutterably effaced, no one and no. A vanishing vestige like a violet trace, a faint record merely of a self now past. She was a point in the unknowable. Only some last annulment now remained, annihilation's vague, indefinable step. A memory of being still was there and kept her separate from nothingness. She was in that, but still became not that. This shadow of herself, so close to naught, could be again self's point d'appui to live, return out of the inconceivable, and be what some mysterious vast might choose, even as the unknowable decreed. She might be naught, or new become the all, or if the omnipotent nihil took a shape, emerge as someone and redeem the world. Even she might learn what the mystic cipher held, this seeming exit or closed end of all, could be a blind, tenebrous passage screened from sight, her state the eclipsing shell of a darkened sun on its secret way to the ineffable. Even now, her splendid being might flame back out of the silence and the nullity, a gleaming portion of the all-wonderful, a power of some all-affirming absolute, a shining mirror of the eternal truth, to show to the one and all its manifest face, to the souls of men their deep identity. Or she might wake into God's quietude, beyond the cosmic day and cosmic night, and rest appeased in his white eternity. But this was now unreal or remote, or covered in the mystic fathomless blank. In infinite nothingness was the ultimate sign, or else the real was the unknowable. A lonely absolute negated all. It effaced the ignorant world from its solitude and drowned the soul in its everlasting peace. That was the end of Canto 6. Namaste, Jai Ma.